Support for The Best of Our Knowledge comes from the College of St. Rose in Albany, offering master's and certificate programs for working adults looking to advance or change their careers. Easily accessible to downtown and state offices, the College of St. Rose has served the Capital District since 1920. strose.edu/grad programs for applications.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If there's one area of education that demands a hands-on learning experience, it's the field of medicine. And not just for new students. Doctors in the field need continuous training to stay up to date on the latest advances.
Our main target audience is focused on training our frontline VA healthcare providers.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, it's road trip time as we tour the Veterans Administration's SimLearn Training Center in Central Florida. We'll also chat with the Dean of the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine about 21st century medical education, join some med students who spent the spring break touring the inner city, and spend an academic minute with racial diversity nowhere near the city. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. For years, we've been hearing about problems at VA hospitals around the country. Long waits for appointments and outdated facilities are some of the most common complaints. Then there's the VA Medical Center at Lake Nona, Florida, just outside Orlando. This 1.2 million square foot facility is almost like a palace. It's located on a 65-acre campus and cost $600 million to construct. Located on that campus is a state-of-the-art training center for VA doctors. Dr. Haru Okuda is the National Medical Director for the Department of Veterans Affairs Simulation Learning Education and Research Network, or SimLearn program. I recently took a tour of this facility and talked to Dr. Okuda about this educational center for doctors.
The National Simulation Center of the VA is a 51,000 square foot immersive training center for healthcare providers. What's unique about this center is that the focus is not on trainees like medical students, nursing students, or residents. The focus is on our existing workforce, our frontline docs, our frontline nurses, and the gap that we're trying to fill is multifold, but many include teamwork, communication skills and training, incorporating and learning new technologies that are being developed by industry, and getting our docs and nurses proficient with those new technologies, and then evaluating some of the newer procedures and technologies that are coming out to help our frontline workforce.
And this is a fairly new facility, isn't it?
Absolutely. This was built. We did our ribbon cutting in September of 2016. We were established or approved to be established in 2009. So it's been a long time coming.
And you're primarily doing VA doctors, right?
That's correct. Our main target audience is focused on training our frontline VA healthcare providers. So doctors are some of them, but nurses, respiratory therapists, mental health, social workers, etc.
You're training doctors who have been in the field some, 10, 20, 30 years. How do they feel on coming in and working on mannequins?
So it varies. I think a lot of the younger generation doctors that are coming out, they may have experienced this in their training, and they expect it when they come out, and they're very excited about it. Some of the more senior doctors that have been out for a while, it varies in their adoption. Some are very excited because they understand how the technology can help them close some of the gaps that they foresee on their own. Others are a little bit more apprehensive and say, what is this technology? Is this really patients? I don't really believe in it. But I would say majority, over 99% of the folks that come through here by the end of the training are immersed. They give a lot of positive feedback on their experience. They feel is value added.
And is this doctors from all over the country?
Over 150 healthcare sites across the organization with 20,000 doctors and I think over 90,000 nurses and other healthcare folks is our target audience.
This is a huge facility.
It is very big. It's probably one of the top 10 biggest in the country. But if you think about our target population, I mean, the VHA has over 300,000 staff. If you talk square footage per staff, it's not that big. And I think, if you want to create a true immersive training experience for the different kinds of healthcare teams, from operating room to the ICU to outpatient clinics to mental health to ERs, you need the space to be able to recreate their immersive experience.
And how many are you training?
Our goal is to train over 2,000 a year as instructors coming through the facility, and then they'll go back and it'll be an exponential effect because then they're going to start training folks locally as well.
How is a doctor chosen for the training? It's like, okay, this guy from Cincinnati needed to come here and learn this.
So what we do is we reach out to the leadership at each facility and say we're looking for experts in both the content as well as instruction and in certain topic areas. And then they're identified by their chief of staff or the chief of nursing, and then they're sent over to our facility.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing healthcare modeling simulation since probably about 15 years now. I started out in New York building the simulation program for the New York City Public Health System and came over here about 6 years ago.
Part of the training at the center involves games. Dr. Okuda says this is a new addition to doctor education at the VA.
The VA has a division that focuses developing training on seeing the effectiveness of educational games for our healthcare providers. We actually adopted a lot of the best practices already used from the Department of Defense, who use serious games for training their warfighters. And so what we're trying to do is seeing if we can bridge some of our learning competencies using different types of educational games for both team training skills, some of the knowledge pieces. And we're finding it being very effective, but it's still very new in healthcare, so we're still evaluating it and how to deploy it.
So are we talking video games?
It's like a screen-based educational game, yeah.
Is virtual reality not too far off?
We are standing up a virtual reality footprint within our facility, a virtual and augmented reality.
Walking around the facility with about a dozen other journalists from around the country, Dr. Okuda pointed out different simulation areas of the building in a wide variety of specialties.
So this is not as, I mean, it's exciting, but to me, as an ER doc, I like the you know, the blood and all that, the gores and stuff. This is our outpatient clinic area. So, you know, on the left, we have you do general clinic rooms. On the right, we have like dental simulators and ophthalmology simulators, etc.
Dr. Okuda also talked about the mental health simulation room to help doctors prepare for veterans with PTSD and other mental health conditions.
It's a room it prevents folks from harming themselves. So it has different kind of furniture. I mean, you wonder, you saw the report on the gentleman, the athlete that hung himself in a jail. And you go, well, how do they do that, right? And so I used to work in a level one trauma center in Queens, and we had a lot of inmates from Rikers Island, and we'd have people trying to hang themselves. And what they do is they take their sheets and they hang it to some doorknob or something. Most of the times, it's not somebody from the ceiling. It's like they're trying to hang themselves like kind of sideways off something low, down low. So these mental health rooms are built so that you don't have the ability. There's nothing in there that you can harm yourself on. And so because mental health is such a big area of focus within the VA, obviously we needed to build in the capabilities to do mental health training. The kind of training that we might do is like de-escalation. So if somebody gets admitted because they're depressed or suicidal or, you know, have some sort of mental health issue and they start getting really agitated or PTSD and aggressive, you know, you want to ideally you de-escalate verbally, right? That's your initial one. And then if you can't do it that way, then you try to give some sedation and other things to calm them down. So we'll have actors or our staff play roles, and we'll have learning objectives. We'll try to keep it as safe as possible. And you know, if they do the right things that they learn for de-escalation techniques, then they'll back off, right? But if they don't meet their objectives, then they'll escalate, just like a patient would.
Rather than looking like a school, the SimLearn Center has the appearance of a typical VA hospital. In fact, if you were to walk through the center, you probably wouldn't be able to tell it was a simulation center until you saw the mannequins on the beds.
So you want to train, in the military they say train as you fight, okay, right? And so you want to train in the environment that's most familiar to you, because you know, if you have learners coming in and they're in an unfamiliar environment, they're not going to learn. They're going to be trying to figure out the environment. So you want to recreate the environment. And the other big thing with healthcare, and I think with a lot of things, is a lot of the errors or issues are systems issues. You know, knowing how to use a piece of equipment, knowing how the process works, you're laying that on top of all the communication and the medical problems. So we sometimes will integrate some of the room issues or equipment failures as part of the training.
Okay. Is there anything you can't simulate now or would like to simulate better?
So the gushy stuff on the inside. So doing actual surgeries is tricky. I mean, there are some, we haven't done it yet, but there are some facilities that have taken, there aren't simulators that do this off the market yet, but they'll actually, one of our sites out in San Francisco cored out one of their mannequins, and they bought a simulated heart. They threw it in there, And then they were training on something called resternotomy. So if a person just recently had a cardiac surgery and they go into cardiac arrest, you know, most of the people, the manager, if you go into cardiac arrest, you push on a chest. But in this specific target group, is there a problem with bleeding around the heart? And if there is, you need to decompress it quickly, right? But if you just push on the chest, they're never going to survive if they're bleeding around the heart. So they had to teach them how do you really quickly open the chest, look at what the issues are, and fix the issue. So there aren't that many simulators that actually have that surgical feel where somebody, that's all done in virtual reality, where, you know, physically you can go in and fix the heart, or physically you can suture the belly, the intestines. I don't know of mannequins that quite do that yet.
So a lot of still being used cadavers then.
A lot of cadaver use, or in some places we don't do it, but live animals, you know, they do some work with that for training and procedures.
Dr. Haru Okuda is the National Medical Director for the Department of Veterans Affairs SimLearn program. You can see pictures of the center and find links to more information on the Best of Our Knowledge page at WAMC.org. And thanks to the Association of Healthcare Journalists for bringing us along to their annual conference and to this tour, and to the Leona M. and Harry B. Helmsley Charitable Trust for providing us with a fellowship to attend. Still to come, teaching 21st century medicine means continuing education and innovation. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Using simulations is one major advancement in medical education, but there have been countless other innovations in the field over the past few decades. While attending the Association of Healthcare Journalists Conference in Orlando, we caught up with Dr. Michelle Halyard, the interim dean of the Arizona campus of the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine. She had just given a talk about advances in 21st century medical training, and I asked her, looking back, how different was 20th century medicine from 19th century?
Well, I think with 20th century medicine or 19th century medicine, the focus was really on the patient. It was much more of a cottage industry. It was very much, you have your stethoscope, your patient, your book, and you focus there. As we look at the complexities of the healthcare system moving forward, there are much more greater complexities. People need to understand how the healthcare system really plays a role in patient care.
And looking now, going from the 20th to the 21st century, is it a bigger change than that?
It truly is. So the skills that the physicians of the future need, or the current physicians, is really understanding the healthcare delivery system, how to improve quality, drive down cost, improve access of care for patients, improve the systems that we bring to bear to enhance patient care.
Is it just a new way of teaching pretty much the same stuff, or is there a lot of new stuff too?
There's a lot of new things that we're bringing into our curriculum in the science of healthcare delivery, including systems engineering, principles of leadership, principles of shared communication, principles of wellness, which hasn't been focused upon in medical education as much as it should. So it's really adding content to the education of our physicians that really wasn't there before within medical education.
You spoke of Mayo having the science of healthcare delivery. Is that a big innovation?
It is. It really is taking all of the pieces that we feel that a medical student needs, the competencies that they need to be an effective physician, to not only take care of patients, to, as we say, to heal the sick, but also help to heal the healthcare delivery system. And so we really feel that this is a quantum leap forward in bringing together all of those components into a coherent, integrated curriculum.
You spoke there about teaching physicians to work as a team. once they get into the real world and into with doctors who have never worked in a team, how are they integrating that in? Yes.
So team-based care is really a hallmark of Mayo. That's what we've been known for 150 years. So really teaching our students how to take advantage of all the members of the healthcare profession that can bring healthcare to patients. And that includes nurses, therapists, social workers, but it also includes integrating community resources. So I think by training our medical students who will be the physicians that go out, they can spread this knowledge and help to model the team-based approach. And I think many in healthcare, not only at Mayo, but many understand that the medicine of today and the medicine of the future is team-based care. We just need people that understand what that really means.
Every student in the world is worrying about cost. What is Mayo doing about that?
So Mayo's been fortunate in that we have been able to keep our cost of medical school education below the median. So we've worked hard for that. We've worked hard to provide as much scholarship support as we possibly can to the students with the greatest financial needs. Well, we've been fortunate to have great benefactor support to help us as well. But we also have effective debt management and financial counseling services for our students as well to help them manage their debt load.
We've heard a lot about flipped classrooms, and you do that at Mayo. How is that done?
So a flipped classroom really means that you take a portion of the curriculum and you put it in a web-based format where students can view that prior to coming into the classroom to work on small case-based presentations that help to reinforce what they've learned. And so really, this is like doing your homework before you get into the classroom. So you learn the content, and then you get in and reinforce those principles, but in a web-based environment. This really helps to tag on to what millennials are doing today, or our modern learners as we call them, because a lot of the information that they get is outside of what's actually lectured to them. So we actually say that with the flipped classroom, instead of being a sage on the stage, the faculty become a guide on the side. They give the students some of the content prior to them coming into class, and then through small group interaction, they learn to reinforce those principles.
Are there parts of physician training that are just always going to be parts of physician training?
There are parts of physician training, yes, such as you've got to put in those long hours to learn. You've got to put in the hours to learn not only in the classroom, but also to learn in the clinical environment. And continuous learning, lifelong learning, is always going to be a part of medical education, whether you're a medical student, a resident, or a practicing physician. And we instill in our students how to learn outside of a classroom setting, how to understand what's credible medical information, credible resources, and bring that to bear to growing their knowledge base.
Looking at the changes in the past 20 years, what's it going to look like 10, 20 years from now?
I think it's going to only get better. I think as we put more emphasis on improving quality, controlling cost, making sure that the patient is at the center of the healthcare system rather than all the other peripheral distractions, I'm very optimistic for the future.
Dr. Michelle Halyard is the interim dean of the Arizona campus of the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine. Some medical students at the University of Buffalo spent their spring break this semester learning about impoverished sections of the city of Buffalo as part of the Buffalo Community Immersion Program, which is sponsored by the UB Center for Medical Humanities. From station WBFO in Buffalo, Eileen Buckley joined nearly a dozen students as they conducted a walking tour of an East Side community.
People think it's a bad place, and even the people who live in it think it's a bad place.
Dr. Henry Taylor is a UB professor of urban and regional planning. He led the medical students on a walk around an East Side block. It started along Fillmore Avenue and headed down Urban Street. He pointed out blight, from broken sidewalks to decaying homes, burned out property, and debris.
And that they have a powerful effect on the health outcomes of folks.
Taylor describing the conditions within the African American neighborhood, blaming long-time government decisions for much of the blight. The tour is designed to provide a better understanding of real-life issues, as the students will encounter when they begin working directly with patients in their third year during clinical rotations.
These conditions exist because a political decision has been made that this is okay. that this is right.
The students began the lecture at Hopewell Baptist Church on Fillmore Avenue, listening to some parishioners who live in the neighborhood.
I just wanted to come to just give a different perspective because looks are deceiving.
Chinetta Odom is with the church. She's hopeful this lesson for the future doctors will teach them to be sensitive to someone's social, economic background.
Until you actually lived in a broken home or no water, no light, windows broken, afraid of being robbed or God knows what, it's hard to explain.
I don't think it's really anything you can just learn in an academic setting.
First-year medical student Emily Zoe of Williamsville reacting to the tour.
I bet you've probably never walked through the east side like this.
Yeah, I've never really experienced this side of the city. And I actually didn't know too much about downtown in general. So it was just like a really great experience because you learn about things in an academic setting, and it's very different when you're actually in the community and you get to hear people's experiences. And, it definitely will affect how we practice medicine.
We talk in the medical school about cultural competence and the necessity of understanding our patients, not only their cultural and social beliefs, but really their day-to-day lives and experiences.
UBE's Dr. Linda Pressar is director of the Center for Medical Humanities. She explained the importance of bringing medical students out of the classroom in their first year, teaching them the human side of life.
Their distrust about physicians and about the medical establishment. They distrust our prescriptions, that they go on the internet and look at side effects. Every drug has terrible side effects. The frequency is very rare.
The week-long program continues today, and students will visit with the Yemeni community in Lackawanna, speaking with Yemeni women about health care.
We will speak to them about their experiences with physicians in Yemen and in the United States, and issues, for example, their discomfort with seeing male physicians.
Students will also visit a mosque, then tour one of the city's poorest white communities in the Babcock neighborhood. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
The inner city isn't the only place you can find racial diversity in the U.S., and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Is racial diversity confined to big cities? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jennifer Van Hook, professor of sociology and demography at Penn State University, looks at the diversity of rural America and whether it's here to stay.
A common stereotype about rural areas is that most of the people living in those places are white. But demographers have found that racial and ethnic diversity is no longer confined to big cities. Rather, nearly all communities, including 9 out of 10 rural places, are becoming more diverse. The racial and ethnic diversity we see today stems in large part from the wave of immigration that started around 1965. However, we are now entering a new era in which the minority groups will soon be self-sustained by natural growth, births over deaths, rather than by new immigration. To provide an example, roughly 1/4 of the U.S. population is projected to be Hispanic 50 years from now. This will not change, even if immigration were somehow halted completely. It isn't that Hispanic women have a lot of children. They have only about 2 children each. Rather, it is because children and young adults are much more diverse than older adults. As time passes, the older generations will die and be replaced by the much more diverse younger generations. Reductions in immigration will not change this basic fact. Sociologists and demographers no longer wonder whether diversity will rise, but rather how Americans will respond to it. We know that throughout history, notions of which groups belong as Americans will have expanded again and again. So this suggests that this can happen for today's immigrants too. On the other hand, social science research also suggests that this is more likely to happen if immigrants are given fair chances in schools and in the labor market.
That was Jennifer Van Hook of Penn State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.